So you can see that when you're working with the younger kids, especially, just, you know, they're not going to be able to get all of the intricacies of an epistle down, but certainly they can understand that how we are to treat one another, that have love, that that will help us tremendously in our service to God and not just solving problems, but preventing problems. So with the book of 2 Corinthians here this morning, we're going to see that Paul, we're going to see a lot about the tremendous struggles that he went through. What was it that motivated him? What was it that kept him going through all those difficult things? But before we do, let's get into Acts chapter 19. Let's familiarize ourselves with where we are on this third journey. Paul has started out at Antioch around AD 54, somewhere around the time of the transition from Claudius to which particular Roman emperor after Claudius that was so despised and hated? Rome, right. He goes through the area of Galatia and Phrygia and then finds himself at Ephesus. We remember that who had been at Ephesus briefly and then went over to Corinth? But Apollos. He was very eloquent and he received letters from the brethren there at Ephesus commending him to the brethren at Corinth. So, okay, now what about what books have we studied so far in connection with this third journey? First one was, and there would be, he just passed through the area and wrote back to them, the Galatians. He wrote the Galatian letter. And then he intends to go to Corinth, and it looks like from Acts chapter 19, he intends to go through Macedonia, Corinth, and then pass on to Jerusalem. There are several different plans. The plans get changed somewhat, and we're going to find out that even when he writes 2 Corinthians, he's not done changing his exact travel plans because at one point in time he was going to go from Ephesus straight to Corinth. Now he's going to come back through Macedonia, similar to what his first plan was. But his plan then, again, similar to the first plan, is to go straight to Jerusalem. But he's going to end up having to go back through Macedonia because the Jews plot to kill him. So it kind of gives us an idea of what's going on just from a geographic and movements of Paul's standpoint. By Acts chapter 19, beginning in verse 23, we learn about the silversmiths. Demetrius was a silversmith who made shrines to this Ephesian goddess Diana. The temple was there. We mentioned that about Ephesus. And he called together all these different artisans, craftsmen. Now, not all of them would have made these shrines out of silver. Many of them would have, but there have been shrines found to the goddess Diana that were made out of marble, terracotta, and different things like that. So it may have involved some of those as well. But his point to them is pretty clear. I've tried to highlight it on the slide here. We make these shrines, and it's by this occupation that we have, our wealth brought no small profit to the craftsman. When he speaks to him, he says, we have our prosperity by this trade. And we make these gods with our hands, and our trade, and this trade is in danger of falling into disrepute. Why? Because Paul is teaching against following such things as idols and gods that are made with hands. Now, something we see in here that's really interesting is the amount of productivity that Paul has had in this particular work. Throughout almost all Asia, many have turned away. This Paul has persuaded and turned away many people, saying that there are not gods that are made with hands. So, mentions his concern for the goddess Diana and her reputation, but pretty clear, really, what his main motivation was. We're on the hook here, to borrow my earlier term. We're going to lose our reputation, or our she's going to lose her reputation, but more importantly, we're going to lose our way of life, our wealth. Well, those who were there, they heard this, and they understood the point, and they were mad. I'm sure they had noticed this already, and so Demetrius is really just pointing out what they already knew. So they were in eager agreement with this. Secular history records that the Ephesians had them a really nice amphitheater there. You've been there, evidently. Said it would hold up to maybe 24,500 people. So that was if that's true, that would have been about the largest amphitheater in the world at the time. The largest single place of gathering for people out there. So they liked going there. And they went there often, secular history records, and they got in trouble for it. Because think about the situation. There, we mentioned they were second in prominence within the Roman Empire at that time in terms of their sphere of influence. They were a provincial capital. They were important, wealthy, commercially important, but had this tendency to be flighty and impulsive. Romans didn't like flighty and impulsive. They liked stable, peaceful, quiet. They did not mind cracking down severely if there was a problem. And we're going to see that comes into play. But secular history records this, notices that these Ephesians were somewhat spontaneous when it came to... So they began to shout, "Great is Diana of the Ephesians." The whole city was filled with confusion. They rushed, as their custom was, into the theater. And not only did they do that, they took some of Paul's traveling companions. Evidently, they were looking for Paul, but they didn't find him. But they found some people they had seen with him. And we're introduced to two new people, two traveling companions of Paul here, Gaius and Aristarchus. They were from Macedonia. We don't know if it was Philippi or Thessalonica or Berea or what. They were from that area. Well, they've got them in the theater here. The whole city's hearing all this shouting going on. They're coming in the theater too. And these people are enraged, at least the silversmiths and Demetrius, and they know why they're there. But a lot of people, they don't even know why they're there. Paul wants to go into the theater, maybe address the people, perhaps just to swap places with Gaius and Aristarchus to save them out of this, because they were indefinitely in a perilous situation. Whatever his motive was, the disciples that were in that area wouldn't let him go in. They knew that could be... literally, great peril. And it wasn't just them, some of the Asiarchs, some of the officials that were in that area who were friends of Paul, sent to him, pleading with him not to go in there. Now, these Asiarchs, they were not really Roman leaders. They were pre-Roman. And their influence was waning. As it turns out, the town clerk, his influence was increasing, that position. And it would eventually be the dominant role within the city. But these Asiarchs, they were people who were prominent not only in Ephesus, but all through Asia. And the fact that they were able to come together to send information or to send this word to Paul indicates that they were together. They were typically planning games, things of that nature that they had to pay for of their own partially. So they were prominent people, and they were friends with Paul, and they didn't want him going in there because not rational. They could. And some of the people cried one thing, knows what, and some another. We know one of the things that was prominent in their mind was Paul and these meddlesome Christians were making trouble for their trade. Well, they drew Alexander out of the crowd. Now, this is what's happening inside the theater. Outside the theater, Paul wants to get in and maybe defuse the situation, or at least, like I say, take the place of Gaius and Aristarchus. But inside the theater, there's a contingent of Jews there. And who knows if they knew why they originally got there, but one of them wants to speak to the crowd, Alexander. What he would have said would have been rather interesting. But as soon as the crowd, you know, he motions with his hand to speak, but as soon as he does, they perceive that he's a Jew. Found out somehow, whether by his speech, his clothing, or whatever, he was a Jew. And they didn't want to hear him. And you can imagine why. What would the Jews' position on the goddess Diana be? An idol. And they had no use for that. They didn't uphold it. They would have taught against it. They certainly weren't teaching against it with the same success that Paul was having. They would have probably been a little more exclusive in their preaching against it. But these people knew that the Jews were not in favor of Diana. So for the next 2 hours, they proceeded to persuade everybody that Diana was great, that Diana was important, and that she worshipped and revered and held her in disrespect. So for 2 hours, they shout, "Great Diana of the Ephesians." And doing that for 2 hours probably took some of the steam out of their engine, because next the town clerk wants to speak to him. And this man, as we mentioned, he is one of not only a prominence, he was responsible for the city finances. He's one who drafted all of the proclamations and the edicts that would the Romans would enforce. He was one who was, you could almost say, was the chief legislator and the controller of the city, comptroller and controller of the city. And so they knew who he was, and he quiets the crowd down. I would imagine after 2 hours they wanted quieted them. They're probably pretty tired of shouting that. And so he has this oration that's just really very, very on point. Not maybe accurate in every point, but it certainly does the trick from his perspective. So he says to him, men of Ephesus, who is it that doesn't know that we are the keeper of the temple of Diana, which fell down from Zeus or Jupiter? Everybody knows that. And these men that you've got in here, they've not robbed your temple. They're not blasphemers of your goddess. Now, there could be some debate about that one. Yeah, he wasn't necessarily debating this point, making an assertion. They wouldn't have been, I don't think, unnecessarily disrespectful, but they certainly wouldn't have been upholding Diana. They were teaching against Diana. So that wouldn't be hard for somebody who followed her as being valid. It wouldn't be hard for them to perceive that as being blasphemy. Would have been blasphemous in their opinion, I think. Therefore, if Demetrius and his fellow craftsmen have a case against anybody, courts are open. There are proconsuls. Let them bring their charges against each other, but if you have any other inquiry, it shall be determined in the lawful council. He's telling them to follow the law, that you're not supposed to be in here in a ruckus trying to determine things. And we can see the practical value of that. Half of them didn't know why they were there, or at least greater than half of them didn't know why they were there. The more part, it says. Now notice what he says here in verse 40. We are in danger of being called into question. By whom? Romans. And as we said, the Romans will crack down on them, and they would be severe. There are plenty of instances of that in secular history. Not the least of which would be what happened to the Jews. AD 70 probably is the most severe case of that. Of course, that was an open rebellion by that point. But the point is, you see it in the way the Romans acted, especially during this period. They really just wanted to keep a lid on things. They allowed people to do their thing, but as long as they were peaceful. If they started getting rambunctious, then of course they were going to come shut them down. So he points that out. We're in danger because we don't have a reason for this ruckus meeting that we're having. So when he said that, he dismissed them, and evidently they left. Persecution, however, didn't stop. Take just a moment in your mind and think about what had happened in Ephesus. Paul has been there. He's about to leave for these 3 years. Taught at the school of Tyrannus for 3 months. Taught with the Jews. There was a plot against him by the Jews. In fact, flip over to Acts chapter 20, verse 19. Notice here that when he's talking to the Ephesian elders, James, read that for us, verse 19. In fact, read 18 and 19. So the Jews, they've been working against Paul this whole period of time. They're plotting against him. And in 2 Corinthians, we see more allusions to that. Now, if you'll remember, previously, in the end of 1 Corinthians, in chapter 16, he mentions a great door of opportunity that may have been in connection with the burning of those books of sorcery. In other words, that was a manifestation of the people's willingness to put all that past them. And the attention that would have garnered, the fact that many people would be turning to the Lord away from sorcery, away from all of that, that was good. Now we have the riot. Paul is distressed at this point. He's written the book of 1 Corinthians. This is on his mind at this time. Written the book, and what has he had to do in this book? Correct, 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 correct. He's instructing them. They've got serious problems. He doesn't know how they're going to respond to it. He thought by now he would have already been back with them, but he's not. Had to change his travel plan. He intended to go to them directly, but now instead he sent a letter by Titus. He sent Timothy and Erastus up into Macedonia, so he doesn't have them with him anymore. Now this riot breaks out. The persecution doesn't stop. This was only just only a catalyst, evidently, from what we see in 2 Corinthians. So Paul's situation at this point in time is very distressed. And that's one reason why the book of 2 Corinthians is such an encouraging book to us, because we're no better than Paul, for sure. And if we try 2 Timothy 3:12, all who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. We'll suffer persecution. There are going to be times like Paul where we're going to be discouraged. When we talk about discouragement, maybe even despair, a lot of times we mention Elijah. And that's right, because he was very discouraged. Very much, I think, in the same way that Paul is at this point. But I think it's a better example to me is Paul right here in this point in his ministry, in his work. And as we think about the book of 2 Corinthians, helps us to understand why he felt this way. It wasn't just a bump in the road. He despaired of life because these people were trying to kill him, and he had already been through a great deal. And I think that's kind of the way Elijah felt. You know, he had done these things for the Lord. They had had the competition at Mount Carmel. He had shown the people that it is Jehovah that is God. They shouted it with their own lips, and yet nothing was really changing. I think for Paul to see the things were really starting to move, people were moving toward the Lord, then to have all of these things happen seemed rather defeating. I think from Paul's perspective, his concern for the Corinthians so great, it made him wonder. And he wrote this in several of his lessons. I'm concerned to the Galatians that our work among you was in vain. He's not positive that the work among the Corinthians wasn't in vain, from the sense that they wouldn't ultimately be saved. All right, so let's look at the outline of the book of 2 Corinthians. Any comments? Yeah, he says in 1 Corinthians, I didn't come to you with persuasive speech, but in humility. This is something that in some ways they would hold against him, though many would appreciate it, but then those who came in to try to undo his work would point to it and say, Paul, he's weak. He's weak when he's with you, but boy, he can talk big when he's away from you. So people would use that. And Paul is trying to make the point, I'm trying to be gentle. I don't want to come to you with harshness. I want to come to you in love. Who's going to cheer me? Not you. But if I'm making you sorrowful, and I come to you in that sorrow and have to be severe, then not only are you going to be more sorrowful, but who's going to cheer me in what I'm doing? Not just cheer me up in a trivial sense, but who's going to encourage me in the work? And Paul was a human being. He needed that just like anybody did. And we see that humanity of Paul here tremendously on display in 2 Corinthians. And that brings us to our word. Our word for 2 Corinthians would be comfort or consolation. When we think of the word comfort, we really think about back in an easy chair, no problems, we got everything we need. Bears just right. That's comfort to us. The word being used here is consolation, really, has a much deeper meaning. It doesn't mean an absence of conflict or an absence of any difficulty, but rather it means that he had the sustaining encouragement that he needed because of the work that he was doing. That he knew that it was work God wanted done. He knew that though he wasn't, as he says, wasn't sufficient for this work, God would make him strong enough, make him sufficient for it. So these first seven chapters, and by the way, 2 Corinthians breaks down very neatly into three sections. First section being chapters 1 through 7, which talk about comfort. It is the key thought in those verses. Chapter 1 through 2:17, main idea there being comfort in one another. Chapter 3, 1 through 4, 18, comfort in the work of the gospel. And this section here really is just a beautiful section in chapter 5, 2, that tells us his perspective and the perspective we should have in doing the work. There are going to be times, just like Paul, we're exhausted. There are going to be times when we're not sure exactly what to do next, how to do it best. There are going to be times when we're discouraged and there's nobody encouraging us. But the work is God's work. We have this treasure in these old pots of clay. We have this treasure in earthen vessels, he said. That's why we keep going, because it's God's work. We can do it. We're not sufficient for it. None of us are. Paul wasn't. But God made him sufficient. God gave him what he needed to do. And then he talks about the comfort and grace, the comfort that he has in the grace and hope in the ministry. In other words, we're doing this. It's God's work. We're going to be rewarded for it too. That compels us to continue. Chapters 8 and 9 are instructions and encouragement regarding the collection. Really doesn't fit so much with the theme of comfort, but it would for the Judean Christians, wouldn't it? They were going to be sending comfort and encouragement to those brethren, and it was important that they fulfill what they had committed already that they would, and Paul is encouraging them to do it. And then he addresses those who are trying to tear down his work. Key thing to get into our minds, and of course the minds of our students here, is Paul needed to do this. Paul was uncomfortable. You see it over and over as he's making his defense. You know, I speak as fools. I speak as if I'm a child here. Because he had to condescend. He had to come down to their level. They were leveling accusations against him. He couldn't not answer them. So he answers them. But he don't like answering them because they draw attention to him. He wasn't comfortable with that. But he defends what he's preaching. And then here he compares himself to his attackers. And this is the section when he mentions some of the things he'd been through. And I doubt any of his attackers had a list that would compare. I don't know of anybody who would. And then he gives his proofs of apostleship, the visions that he had seen, word that he was teaching, warnings that they should be careful. 2 Corinthians 13:5 comes to mind, 5 or 15. Examine yourself as to whether or not you're in the faith. That's a warning that pierces through the centuries rather clearly and with good effect if we consider it. All right. In it, we're not going to be able to look at every verse, so I just picked some. I don't know if they're the right verses, but they are the ones that caught my attention as I was studying through this. And we mentioned that word comfort. Look at this, just this brief section of three verses here. The word is found there 6 times if we count consolation, which is essentially the same word. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and all comfort, who comforts us in all our tribulation. Remember, we said that the comfort here is not a comfort of no problems. It's a comfort of knowing we're doing right, that we're doing God's work, even though there are problems. That we may be able to comfort those who are in any trouble with the comfort ourselves are comforted by God. For as the sufferings of Christ abound in us, so our consolation also abounds through Christ. We're going through these things, but we know Christ did that too. We know that the reward is there. We can continue despite the tribulations. Now, he's not making light of the tribulations here right off the bat. What he's saying is ultimately the conclusion of this, right from the beginning, the summary, is God is the source of comfort. Now, what was he being comforted through, or despite of, verse 8, chapter 1? We don't want you to be ignorant, brethren, of our trouble which came to us in Asia, that we were burdened beyond measure, above strength, so that we despaired even of life. Yes, we had the sentence of death in ourselves. Why? So that we should not trust in ourselves, but in God who raises the dead. How bad was it, Paul? It was bad. Bad, bad. They had things that we mentioned, and I think key among those, not Paul's, he was concerned certainly for his own life. There's no question. I think he was acutely concerned for his brethren at Ephesus because they were now enduring a very harsh trial. There had been evidently some periods of peace and prosperity in the work. Now that seems to be dissolving. Corinth has got problems. Timothy and Erastus is not with. Titus is gone. His brethren may not, many of them may be killed. We had the sentence of death in ourselves. Bad. How bad? He's despairing even of life. We despaired life. And that really does draw your mind back to Elisha, doesn't it? Elijah. What did he say? Take me. I'm no better than my fathers because I'm the last one left and they want to kill me over with because it's no use trying. Paul doesn't say it's no use trying, but he's certainly feeling the pressure. It's a tremendous, tremendous weight and a burden for him. Later in the chapter, in 12, he begins to talk about their ministry. For our boasting is this, the testimony of our conscience, that we conducted ourselves in the world in simplicity and godly sincerity, not with fleshly wisdom, but by the grace of God and more abundantly toward you. Simplicity doesn't mean simple-mindedness. We know that in the Proverbs, simple-mindedness is condemned. God doesn't want us to be simple in that we don't understand things. The simplicity here is the opposite of duplicity. In other words, Paul was a WYSIWYG person. What you see is what you get person. He was what you saw. Paul was not duplicitous. And he wasn't coming to them, as he mentions in 1 Corinthians, those first four chapters, with fleshly wisdom. He was coming to them with godly wisdom, godly sincerity. That was a consolation for him as well, that he knew that was what they were doing. And that was their boasting. And their confidence was this. Now, and in this confidence, I should say, he intended to come to them before that they might have a second benefit. Remember, in the second journey, he came to Corinth for the first time from Athens. Spent about a year and a half with them. They had certainly benefited by that. Wanted to come by them. He wanted to go by way of Macedonia. Now, this time he mentions, in Acts chapter 19, he mentions there and then Macedonia there in Jerusalem. Here he wanted to pass to Macedonia, come again from Macedonia to you, and be helped on his way to Judea. Therefore, was I planning this lightly? Did I plan to do this lightly? See, he's taking some criticism, evidently, for changing his plans. But they needed to understand, circumstances surrounding Paul were changing all the time. It was his intention to let them know that he was coming, to encourage them, to benefit them a second time, and to receive their encouragement by seeing that they were well in the Lord. The plan, things that I plan, do I plan according to the flesh? That with me there should be yes, yes, no, no. But as God is faithful, our word to you was not yes and no. In other words, they had been straightforward. They were his sincere plans for good reason, to give them benefit. But as he mentions later, he didn't want to have to come to them in earnest. Those, you recall whose house it was that had provided some information regarding what had happened? Household of Chloe. Timothy had gone over evidently and come back. Apollos, whenever we read 1 Corinthians chapter 16, Apollos is in Ephesus. We know he had been in Corinth. So he could have brought some of that word to him too. I failed to mention that the other day. I was thinking about that after the class. And Apollos was back in Ephesus at that time. At any rate, he had changed his plans for good reason. Didn't know what that was going to happen. Chapter 2. In this section, we call a consolation in the midst of despair, probably better of consolation in the midst of tribulation, difficulties. I determined myself that I wouldn't come to you again in sorrow. Because if I come to you in sorrow, that is, if he's having to correct them and deal with these problems in real time, things take time to work through. Paul is there. While the problems all exist, he's going to have to be dealing with them constantly, constantly correcting. He didn't want that. He wanted to give them a chance to receive the letter, the instruction from God, and have time to work it out themselves so that when he came, he would know that they were in good shape. Or at least they were making progress. And he could say with all honesty, you're doing good. And he could encourage them to keep doing good. But if he went to them now, it would have been... So he's explaining why he made his changes. Then who is he who makes me glad but the one who is made sorrowful by me? Okay? Now, notice this too. We have a picture into Paul's heart, verse 4. For out of much affliction and anguish of heart I wrote to you, with not that you should be grieved, but that you might know the love which I have so abundantly for you. Interesting that he mentioned the context of his writing 1 Corinthians. What was his state of mind? It wasn't easy to write those things. You remember chapter 11, do I praise you in this? No, I do not praise you in this. They would suffer. I do not praise you in that. He couldn't praise them in that. So for Paul, he didn't take joy. He wasn't eager to have to be harsh, to correct them in this very stern way. Out of much affliction and anguish of heart. Not only for what he was having to do, but for the fact that those problems existed. He would much rather, I think, have had a situation where they were, instead of turned inward, they were doing the Lord's work outwardly. They were being proactive instead of reactive. So that's his state of mind as he's writing to them that first letter. Now he comes to the subject of the that was dealt with in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, the offender, the one who had his father's wife. Punishment, he says, which was inflicted by the majority, is sufficient for such a man. Now, we're in chapter 2. He hasn't talked yet about Titus coming, but we know that at this point in time, he knows how they received the letter. Even though he's describing the situation before he knew, he knows. Titus has come to him. He's met him in Macedonia. And he mentions that they have inflicted it, this particular punishment. It was done by the majority. That may imply that not everybody did it. I think it does. But it's sufficient. So that on the contrary, you ought to rather forgive and comfort him, lest perhaps such a one be swallowed up with too much sorrow. Therefore, I urge you to reaffirm your love to him. Paul knew that this man had evidently repented, and there were some who would be tempted perhaps not to fully forgive him now that they are no longer tolerant of the situation and be overly harsh toward this man, and that wouldn't be for his benefit either. This end I also wrote that I might put you to the test whether you're obedient in all things. Now whom you forgive anything, I also forgive. For if indeed I have forgiven anything, I have forgiven that one for your sakes in the presence of Christ. Now notice this last expression in verse 11. Lest Satan should take advantage of us, for we are not ignorant of his devices. Now in this context, as we've got it kind of firmly fixed in our mind, what is Satan doing here? What was Paul concerned would happen? Certainly concerned, not the obvious, but certainly concerned that this man would be swallowed up in too much sorrow. He was concerned that his brethren wouldn't forgive. What was he concerned that Satan would take advantage of? I think it really has a lot to do with that main theme in 1 Corinthians. If they didn't manifest the love, reaffirm your love to him here in verse 8. If they didn't manifest that, Satan can take advantage of that. That is, when brethren do not treat one another in love, they have, it's as if they have a big old club in their hand and they say, Satan, but I'm going to use it here. Here, take this and beat me on the head with it. And we really have to love one another. And I think that's Paul's point here. We're not ignorant of that. When we don't have a compassion, number one, he was beating them over the head when they ignored it. So that's not good. Then they deal with it correctly. That was good. But now there's another danger. If they don't reaffirm their love, he gets the club back. Then he beats you over the head with that. Satan couldn't care less how he destroys us. He just wants to destroy us. He'll do it with righteous indignation if we carry it too far. And he'll do it with lethargy, where we just don't seem to care. He'll beat us over the head either way. And I think that's Paul's concern here. We'll touch briefly on close to chapter 3. Verse 12. Furthermore, when I came to Troas to preach Christ's gospel, and the door was opened to me by the Lord, I had no rest in my spirit. I did not find Titus, my brother, but taking leave of him, I departed from Macedonia. Anything in this section that really, really tells us how bad it was for Paul, I think it's this section right here. Know anything about Paul, we know that he was consumed with doing the work of the Lord. He loved his brethren. He wanted desperately to reach as many people as possible. What does Paul say here? I had a great door. I had a door open to me by the Lord at Troas. Now, if we knew nothing more than what we know before this verse, what would we think the next verses would say? That he took advantage of that door of opportunity, that Paul acted consistently. There's a saying in hiring, when you're hiring people, best indicator of future performance is past performance. And we know Paul's past performance. He's been somebody who has diligently, tirelessly sought to serve God by reaching out to the lost. He has a great opportunity or an opportunity to do this, but by taking leave, I couldn't. That tells you how distraught Paul was. He was despairing. He really, really was concerned about these Corinthians. And if you're a Corinthian and you hear that and you know Paul, that would say a lot to you. Paul had an opportunity to preach at Troas. He had a door of opportunity open to him. Take advantage. Why? Because he was worried about us. Now, thanks be to God. Now, this right here, I put this in blue because there should be a big line right here in our mind. This is a distressed Paul. This is a happy Paul. The one thing that we can see that happened between here is Titus showed up. We're going to see that explicitly in chapter 7, about verse 5 or 6, somewhere in that neighborhood. But here he makes an allusion to it. Now, thanks be to God who always leads us in triumph in Christ and through us diffuses the fragrance of His knowledge in every place. Isn't that? I mean, you can see that he's thinking back on how he... Because now he knows Titus has come and he sees the triumph that is in Christ. They received the letter. They were acting on it. And we'll pick up in chapter 3 on next Sunday morning.